Campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Ye Bear and Ye Cub is believed to be the first English-speaking language ever performed in the New World, and as a portent of the future, it had a rebellious nature. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The play was written by William Darby in 1665, first performed in Accomack County, Virginia. It was most likely filled with slapstick comedy. The site of the performance was probably a tavern in Punkatee. But this was also a time of King Charles II, and the colonies were already chafing under the mercantile control of those in London. The original copy of the play is believed to have been lost, but Professor Joel Ice has written a work called The Play in August, which tells a light, imaginative story of how it may have come about. It even contains a tiny version of the original concept. He joins us in studio along with Dr. Ray Thompson, director of the NAB Resource Center for Delmarva History and Culture. Welcome to you both. Well, Dr. Thompson, I want to turn to you. Why don't you set the stage here for what the Eastern Shore was like and this relationship that clearly plays out on the play and between London on the one hand and the colonies, and particularly Virginia on the other.
Well, the Eastern Shore of Virginia had been settled for less than 50 years by this time. The first settlement was 1615. There were probably only 1,000 people, English or European settlers, on the Eastern Shore, perhaps as many as 200 or 250 Native Americans at this time. It was pretty much a frontier environment, and I guess we could say it was a rough and tumble economy. It wasn't at all like what life would have been in the more settled areas of Europe. So during the period of the Commonwealth, when there was no king in England, the colonies had the colony of Virginia had pretty much been left on its own. During that period of time, there was, believe it or not, down here on the Eastern Shore of Virginia, a fairly heavy Puritan sympathy, although we tend to think of Puritans being in New England. But it was because of the trade. There was a good deal of trade between the people of the Eastern Shore of Virginia and the New England colonies. And that trade, once the English king came back into power, was beginning to be curtailed. The English decided they wanted to have a part in this economic boom that the Dutch were experiencing, because the Dutch were basically the main carriers of trade throughout the Atlantic at the time. So the English passed a series of navigation laws severely inhibiting and finally prohibiting anyone but English ships from carrying any Virginia goods back to England.
So in terms of the kinds of trade we're looking at, what is it that Virginia had that then was being exported to London and to England, and then what happened to those goods as they were processed and went somewhere else? Explain that structure there.
Well, there were two primary products which were being sent back to to Europe. The first, of course, was tobacco. Virginia tobacco by this time had become a very desirable tobacco, unlike it had been in the early years. And the second material was beaver. Beaver skins were in great demand, and those two materials were basically the money of the time. Everyone in England wanted to have a beaver hat. If you've ever seen a picture of Pocahontas when she was that famous picture, she has a beaver hat. All of the Vermeer paintings show men and women with beaver hats, so it's such an important part. But tobacco was what was also the a major point. An individual person could raise about 1,500 pounds of tobacco in a year. So it was something that was very important.
Now, describe to us the people who came here, and we see this reflected in the play, that there are indentured servants, mm-hmm. and there are people who were indentured and now they're not,
right.
and as well as others who obviously were not indentured at all. What was that system like?
Well, It's been estimated that about 75% of the people who came to Virginia started out as indentured servants. And we're at a very important period here between 1620 and 1645. This window was a window like none other in, American history. It was a time when a person could come as an indentured servant, work his way out of his indenture, and become not only a planter, but a very prosperous a commissioner. And that doesn't happen after about 1645, 1650. So by 1660, when the play that Dr. Ice will be talking to us about was in the 1660s, when that was being formulated, it was a new kind of attitude. It was a much more constrictive attitude that people couldn't move as quickly socially from the lower levels up to the upper levels. It becomes much more rigid. The society becomes much more rigid.
Now, I also, by the way, understand that there's a relationship between the number of indentured servants you might have in relationship to the kind of amount of property that you had. How did that work?
Well, for each indentured servant, the person who brought them over received 50 acres. Now, that will change later on. But if you brought over a substantial number of indentures, then you would have a lot of a big piece of property yourself. You wouldn't really need a huge amount of property because it didn't take a lot of land to create what you needed each year. Every third year, the land had to be changed. However, you had to let the land lay fallow and girdle the trees in new areas and really create a new system of fields.
I want to turn to Professor Ice. How did you become interested in what would seem to be fairly obscure? That is, there is this play, and I want to talk to you about it in a minute, but the Eastern Shore is pretty well separated from most of the rest of the country. Matter of fact, it was isolated for many years until they built the infamous bridge, which some people still complain about. How did you become interested in this whole area?
As always, it's connected with family. I was already a teacher, professor of theater, and had studied theater. I worked as a professional actor and designer in the West Coast. And my cousin, Doris Adler, Dr. Doris Adler, she was head of the English department at Howard University and a fellow of the Folger Library and a regular contributor to the Shakespeare Quarterly, one of the first women writers in the early 70s to that. She lived over here. She moved over to the shore. She loved it over here. And she was doing research on genealogies and some other interesting issues on the Eastern Shore. And I was teaching at State University of West Georgia down in Carrollton. It's connected to the Carroll family from here. Just happened that he was down there and bought property there. We were up visiting her, and she threw me in the car, and she said, "Well, I want to show you something." And she took me out to Punkateek. There's a plaque out there, Virginia State historical plaque, the site of the alleged site of the first play in English in the New World, and so this was holy ground to those of us who tread the boards, and. So I said, well, we got back in the car, and my wife and I are asking her, what do you know about it and all the rest of that? And Doris was from Kentucky, and so we were having dinner, and of course it was chicken and biscuits, and she's got a chicken leg in one hand and a biscuit in the other, and she points the chicken leg at me, and she says, "I'll tell you one thing, it was political." Now, a woman with her particular professional bent as a reader of PhD dissertations and a publisher would have not said anything like that unless she could back it up. So this was her habit. I asked her about it, and she just pointed the chicken leg at me again and said, "Chase it." So there's a lot of evidence right in that very sign about the importance of that particular piece. And it's amazing, if you've done any historical research, usually what you see right in front of you is something that other people don't notice, and you see something there, and you just go, well, how come nobody else notices this? And in the sign, it says that the play was performed on August 27th, which is a Sunday, and the name of the play was Guibert and Yacoub, and everything is right there. Because in 1665, there was a law in place for violation of the Sabbath. So to congregate and to do a play on Sunday was against the law. It's right there in the sign. And the play, The Bear and the Cub, indicates if you had a choice of any kind of play, the political nature of that is right there in the title, because the bear is England and the cub is the colony. And obviously, being a play in a bar, the bear is going to get his comeuppance. He's going to be chased around the bar by the cub. You know, it was obviously sort of Laurel and Hardy situation. That's the kind of play you do in a bar. It was, of course, the end of the harvest season, August 27, and everybody was hanging out on a Sunday instead of being in church. And so the indication that it probable was a comedy, the indication that it probably was going to get him in trouble, and the indication that it probably was illegal has been in people's faces for 350 years. Nobody chased it. And I just happened to the switches snapped closed, and I chased the material in that. Its first reference in theater history is in Quinn's book, 1832-1835. So, and he was in New England. I think he was in New York when he published the book. So as far back as 1830s, it was somehow common knowledge among the theater community that this thing existed, because the only record of it is a handwritten record in the Accomack County courthouse. Somebody must have, known that this occurred to present that material to part of the book. And if you read any theater history book, it's a little paragraph about page 2, because it's so early, which has only that information in it. And everything else had to be, researched and generated. There's some other books about the area that talk about it a little bit. But there was some digging here. It took me 6 years to write the book from which the play is researched.
Let me ask you this. My understanding is that a copy is no longer existent. It doesn't exist anymore. Is that right? Do we have any idea about what happened? Or
the only thing we can refer to is the kind of plays that were being done at the time. Beaumont and Fletcher, some of the other playwrights in the middle 1600s, 1620s, 1630s, wrote what's called the city plays, which were all very broad kind of comic farces, sort of, domestic farces. The kind of thing you see on sitcom television, very much like that, sort of Lucy and Desi situations, or situations where the old fool wants to marry the young girl and he's made a fool of because she's in love with a younger guy, and usually involves things like he gets dressed up like the sister-in-law, and there's all kinds of cross-dressing kind of things. It's an old theatrical tradition, cross-dressing, Shakespearean tradition. So that's the kind of thing that working class people would have seen at the time in the streets or in a private home in that period. So we know that's the source of what it probably was like, and probably very physical comedy, throwing of a tub of water or something, like that.
Now, as we do know that it existed, because as you mentioned a moment ago, there is this court record.
Ah, yes.
And it introduces, and we'll talk a little bit about one of the characters, Edward Martin. Tell us a little bit about what we know about that side of it, because it clearly violated some law. We know that, but it's not clear as to exactly what was going on. Go ahead.
Well, and Dr. Thompson, you can jump in anytime you like. The court requested, this is very interesting, because the play occurred in August and someone filed a complaint, but they didn't file a complaint until late October, early November. And he claimed that he was morally incensed. Now, you have to ask how morally incensed it was. It took him 3.5 months to get worked up filing this complaint. We have a rural community where probably the word of mouth went out that this was going to happen. And so probably everybody and their dog was in this bar, watching this play. Because nothing like this had ever been performed. This was a great diversion. If you read the record, the laws at the time, why there was a court case, was that the judges asked to see such texts as existed. In other words, they wanted to see a written text, if there was one, and there was. They wanted to see the play performed in court, in costume. So they wanted to see whether or not a crime had been committed. The crimes that they were interested in was obviously the highest possible crime they could try somebody on, this good legal principle, was either something lewd, something anti-religious, or something which was against the court. where there was a law which you could not impersonate or insult the personage of the king or the court, anyone who's a court officer, by burlesquing them, the way they dressed or how they spoke or their policies, certainly. So they would not have had to bother with that unless the issue was something of that importance. Because one of the members of the play was an indentured servant. One of the actors in the play. You could not have an indentured servant in a bar because they had no money, because they were property. They were somebody else's property. And this was kind of loose. They did have some money. But you were not allowed to have an indentured servant, and you were not allowed to be in a bar on a Sunday because this is a violation of the Sabbath. Well, the court didn't even bother with that. If it was a small issue like that and they wanted to just be done with it, they would have just fined them a couple of pounds of tobacco because they were obviously not in church, and they had an indentured servant in the bar, but they didn't. They went for the higher charge. So clearly, there was an issue of what was said and how it was performed. The reason that that was of serious interest was King Charles paid a great deal of attention to the theater in England. They instituted the Exchequer. Which was an office you could not perform a play anywhere under the British crown, which would be the colonies or England, without having it previously submitted to the Exchequer for approval. This one didn't go to anybody. It just got performed. So there would have been a violation of the law right there. Even great playwrights like Dryden, his work was all of the playwrights' work was subjected to previous approval by the Exchequer's office. So clearly they were already in hot water at that point in time, so there was an issue. So the question is, if the entire county was sitting at this play in this bar, why is it that only one guy, 3.5 months later, filed a complaint? Well, the play was obviously dealing with the question of freedom against these laws, which were in effect at the time. And all of the farmers and all of the planters were in the bar. Because in this particular location, they were not absentee landlords. All of them lived on the Eastern Shore. It wasn't like someone in England that owned property. Therefore, they were all sitting there. Well, if they were all sitting there in the bar performance and nobody filed a complaint, they had to answer to that fact at the time that this guy filed a complaint. Why did he file a complaint? We'll get into that a little later. But they obviously were all in sympathy with the content of a play, which is why nobody said a word. So that's the issue, that they were all behind the sentiment of the play. And it's interesting, this particular area that we live in here in the Eastern Shore was the first place, the first evidence of a taxation without representation was filed, a petition in 1652, which essentially said, you know, you're asking for our money and you're not asking us to participate in the laws, started here. So really, the spark of revolution began in 1652 in this county, in this area. So they knew that this area was under scrutiny for its independent spirit. So these guys were definitely under the microscope at the time. They took a great deal of risk by doing this, and the entire community was in sympathy. So that's now, the background for that.
Now your play, the one you wrote, yes. A play in August. It, from what I can gather, it is really a play about the writing of this play.
Yes,
in essence, to give for everybody to be clear about it.
Right.
And one of the key characters we mentioned a moment ago is Edward Martin, who is a Quaker.
That's good.
So and I was curious about. You made him a Quaker, maybe he was. You can elucidate that. What is that about? Because he seems to be very straight laced all the way through this. Particularly, a lot of attention to the law. There's a certain prudishness quality about this man. I mean, what? Tell me about this character.
Well, he's an interesting guy. He's at the time of the trial. He's 49 years old, and he's been an indentured servant at that point for 14 years. The normal time of indenturehood was about 2 to 4 years. Why was he an indentured servant for 14 years? They know that he was a Quaker. He would not take an oath of office in the court. He would not defend the colony against Indians. He was actually fined for that at one point in time because the Quakers would not take arms against another human being, another one of God's creatures. So they knew that he was a Quaker. The interesting thing about his moral indignation, which took about 3.5 months to build itself up, was that he had previously been an indentured servant on the same land as Philip Howard. Philip Howard was one of the people in play. So he knew this guy. So here's a 19-year-old guy, you know, in the bunkhouse with a 49-year-old curmudgeon who was probably a royal pain in the neck. He then becomes, at the time of the play, Philip Howard is an indentured servant for the farm next door. And what it seemed to me was this is a good old-fashioned country feud. That maybe he owed the guy money, maybe he was always leaving his boat in the way, or his tools, or he left the gate open, or his dogs were running across the land, or he was cutting down the bushes. One of these things where, you know, your neighbor's a pain in the neck, and Edward Martin was the kind of guy who was the scorekeeper. You know, it's like, you know, Philip Howard is always doing this, always doing that. And finally, something happened, probably between the two of them, could have been an issue of a woman. Something happened between the two of them, and Edward Martin said, that's it, I'm going to get this guy. He was in that play a couple of months ago. I'm going to file a complaint. Why didn't no? Because everybody else in town was in there, and nobody said a word. And this guy was a notorious curmudgeon. He already had a reputation, which is recorded in the court for being a bit of a stick in the mud.
And describe briefly for me the structure of this town. I mean, you have this, obviously you have indentured servants, you have people who are farmers,
right,
and so on. And it seems to me that there's a certain tension that exists in order for this to be brought up in the first place.
Right. The tension that existed was, as Dr. Thompson said, was the economic issue. When the laws were passed in the early 1660s against the free trade, people in the colonies were trading up and down the inside of the eastern seaboard. They could go all the way up to Chesapeake Bay and then take stuff by wagon or even up to New York and down to the Carolinas, which was international trade because the Dutch were running New York and the Spanish were running Carolinas and Florida. So they were carrying on international trade, and the products never went through the warehouses in England. So they were making a decent profit because their cost of shipping and the cost of sales was quite low. Without worrying about the storms on the coast. And when the laws were changed, they received word that they had to ship the stuff, everything to a warehouse in England. And then it had to come back here. And it was the same people in England that were selling them goods. They could not manufacture goods. So these people are paying what they want to for the tobacco and then charging whatever they want and giving the farmers a very slow percentage. It was not a good situation. Their farms were getting to be in foreclosure. The loans against their crops were being called in. And the thing that really put them on the edge was they had received word that in this particular season, at the end of the storm season, the English were going to be sending lawyers to collect the taxes that were owed, and they were going to be sending a regiment of soldiers. This is essentially a reinvasion of their own territory. This was English territory. They were sending English soldiers to enforce the laws against English citizens. And this is like the Quartering Act, which happened later in Boston. But this is 110 years before Boston. So these people were extremely indignant. They were talking about possibly, you know, armed struggle with the English soldiers to protect their land and their property, not to mention their women. And everything else. How were they going to house and feed all these guys? So the situation reached a boiling point. And clearly the play at that moment in time was blowing off steam on that issue and was probably very clear about that.
So why don't you read a little section a section of the film of the play for us.
Coming attractions.
That's right, and okay. Sort of set it up for us.
I will tell you that this is a shameless plug. I'm at the university here at Salisbury University in, I think it's Fulton Hall, on Sunday afternoon. I think it's 1:30. I'm not sure. You might have the information on that. They're going to do a reading of the play, a concert reading of the play by the theater program. So this is sort of coming attractions of a piece of it. I'm not sure any information about how to get to that. I think they can share that with you later. I'm going to read a little section from the beginning of the play. They're standing outside the churchyard, and they're talking about this whole situation for... oh, no, this is the scene in the bar. They're talking about the situation which has gotten them upset. One of the characters is Philip Howard. He's one of the people who eventually is in the play, but at this moment, within the play, at this moment he's just hanging out in the bar. Folks own the bar, and a couple of other farmers and tradesmen are hanging out in the bar, and they're talking. Philip Howard says, "That's a sermon spoke well, Master Thomas, and I shall heed it come next Sabbath. But for now, can we raise a health to the king?" Folks, who owns the tavern, says, "You can raise a health to anyone else, but not to the king this day. He has set his officers to accompany a flock of black-coated crows come to collect our debts, strapped though they know how we are." And one of the other men says, "The debt collectors are bad enough, but this flock in sword and armor is one stroke more than we do warrant." Another man, Watkinson, who is eventually comes out into the play, he's a landowner who's just gotten quite a bit of land, and he's in a bit of a sweat about this. He says, "I've just marked me down for 9 indentured servants and bought 400 acres more of land. I must feed us all and bring in a crop. Half your servants are named on papers only, no matter that. Puppets. What will you say to the king, debtor collectors, when they ask, 'Where are the rest of your hands?'" One of the habits at the time was to create false names. People that didn't exist so you could get more land. It was pretty common practice. And he did that. Got himself in trouble. "There are many here about here stuff their account with names to gain a bit more land to farm. I've had curse enough in this drought bringing in the crop, even if all those names rose out of the earth and put on clothes and boots and took up a hoe. What will I do if these vultures demand their debt be paid to them forthwith?" She's speaking of the lawyers coming up. He says, "Well, Martin in his league will pray for you. He tells us he has the Lord's good ear. So all will turn out well for you then. It's not a joking matter, this business. We cannot trade with the Spanish to the south or the Dutch in New Amsterdam, save that our goods rattle around a bit in an English warehouse first, while the price doubles for the waiting. And then the goods we buy from others must come to us on English ships alone. And there you have it. The good colonies around us have real coin and ready, too. But the London houses mew up the goods like some virgin daughter made more costly for the keeping away. And when she is let out, the dowry we pay is doubled." So that's essentially the situation. One of the challenges with writing a play like this is you have to make the political issues personal. We can all talk about these things in larger terms. But the situation is dangerously close to what's going on with the Occupy Wall Street movement now, where people are essentially working to pay off debts that are manufactured on paper and having nothing to do with our productivity. Nothing's happened to our factories and our people's ability to produce. And that is a close parallel to the situation here. It gets dangerously close to that frame of mind.
Dr. Thomas, I want to turn to you. What do you see as the significance of this play? I mean, we've talked a little bit. He alluded to some of the events that are going today. How does it reflect how we were shaped as a region here in Delmarva?
Well, from the very beginning, this area of Virginia was very independent. I think the people were of a mindset that was quite different from New England. One of the things that concerns me, as I am just listening to you both talk, is that Mr. Martin was a Quaker. And the Quakers were just at this time beginning to be harried out of Virginia. In the 1650s, there were laws that were beginning to oppress the Quakers. And by 1660, they were being literally pushed out of Virginia, the Eastern Shore of Virginia, into Maryland, which was a much more tolerant area. So I wonder if that might not have something to do with what was happening here as well. It's looking at it from a different perspective, but I'm not sure. Mm. Certainly this area from very early on showed itself very interested in being a participant rather than subjects. In 1635, they sent a royal governor back to England because he wasn't doing what they wanted. That's a pretty dramatic thing.
Not only that, I might add, is that the county down there, which was originally Northampton County, the county was so long, physically, geographically long, that the northern half of the county, which became Accomack County, didn't ask for permission to make themselves a county. They just announced that they were, in fact, a separate and unique county, and they elected their own officials and had their own court. And the people in Williamsburg could pretty much just lump it because that was what it was going to be. So the very independent spirit that within a colony, which is already, you know, a subject area, that they would self-govern to the point that they would say, we are our own entity, which is essentially the spirit underneath the Declaration of Independence, that they would do that indicates the independent spirit of this particular part of the world.
And we're going to have to wrap it up there. We've been speaking with Professor Joel Ice, who has written the work, The Play in August, which is about, of course, the making of Ye Bear and Ye Cub. It's believed to be the first English-speaking play ever performed in the New World. Also joining us was Dr. Ray Thompson. He's director of the NAB Resource Center for Delmarva History and Culture. And, of course, the reading will be this Sunday at Fulton Hall. You can contact the university for all the details. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.